Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My name is Mark Boris, and I've teamed up with Stake, one of Australia's top investing platforms, to talk about going public. IPOs are exciting milestones that unlock new capital, draw more attention, and open up opportunities. But a lot happens before and after the trading bell rings, and it's not all glamour. Join me in candid conversations with prominent business leaders as we reveal all the ups and downs of getting a private company listed. Mike Villa, welcome to Going Public, mate.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So you're the co-founder and managing director of HIT IQ. That's HITIQ. What's your ticker?
HIQ.
HIQ. Right. This is on the Australian ASX, or the Australian Stock Exchange, ASX. Let's get into it a little bit here. Maybe tell me a little bit about, you're a tech company, effectively a tech company.
Absolutely.
What do you guys do? Where's your technology sit? What platforms? And you know, hey, and what is your thesis around your technology?
Yeah, good question. So our core technology is a sensor-based mouthguard. So effectively, we instrument mouthguard, a general mouthguard with some high-level technology.
Which have one here.
Correct. And what we're able to do with that tech is capture and quantify head trauma, brain trauma. So we do that in an acute sense. So, you know, how big is an impact, the location of the impact, the direction of that impact, but then also over a longitudinal basis. So, you know, capturing and creating a data bank for athletes across their career.
Right. And your background is that you're a sports scientist?
Correct.
You have, and I don't know what it takes to become a sports scientist, but I guess it's a master's degree in something. That's in science, correct. I guess.
Yeah,
sports science.
Master's degree in exercise science.
Yeah, yes. Exercise science, yeah. And your experience in terms of athletes is where?
So my background probably goes right back to the early 2000s. I was in the US playing collegiate basketball. Had a lot of exposure during that period to American football. Came home, started working in elite sport, and then sort of transitioned into high performance and worked at the AIS.
That's the Australian Institute of Sport.
Absolutely, and did a bunch of consultancy work alongside that. And effectively my role was in injury rehabilitation, strength and conditioning, data management, data science. So, you know, I was pretty well grounded in this space, obviously in a different field, but that translated pretty well to what we're doing now.
So obviously sports injuries or rehab from sports injury covers a lot of territory, particularly if you're looking at runners or compared to basketballers, compared to a rugby league player or a rugby union player, you know, like there's a broad range of sports injuries. Obviously this business specializes in one area. Mm-hmm. It's more about head injury or head trauma, which we'll come back to. But in that process, consulting, contracting, doing stuff with AIS, having experience in the US, what did you learn about head trauma relative to sports people? By the way, head trauma can happen to anybody, not just a sports person, but head trauma relative to a sports person. And what's the difference between a head injury and, say, you know, a bicep tear?
Well, this is why we exist. So the opportunity really presented itself because there's just no data. There's no ground source or truth to what we know about impacts that lead to trauma versus the traditional injuries or you know, that have a background and a longevity of research and science and empirical evidence. We are bringing data to fast track the knowledge base and the management protocols of brain injury, and we're doing that through our mouthguard data. So that's, you know, when you look at traditional injuries versus if you were to segment out brain injuries, the big limitation at the moment with brain injury in sport is data and the lack thereof it. So that's purely why we exist, and that's the opportunity that we're chasing.
The brain's an unusual part of our anatomy. It's, of course, underexplored relative to the rest of our body, and we can do heart surgery, we can do all sorts of things, you know, they can pretty much sort everything out, most things. Brain injury in itself is not a massive problem if there's a rehab program. Diagnosis is not that difficult because, you know, you can diagnose, you know, someone falls on the ground because they got hit on the chin. That's pretty obvious he's got concussion, or she. What is the issue, though, is does that express itself down the track in 25 years' time post-retirement into, you know, I don't want to start a scare campaign, but dementia, CTE, those types of things, any type of brain disease as opposed to the trauma. The question becomes, and that's the big game at the moment. You know, particularly all the contact sports are confronting this at the moment. And we heard what happened in the US with the NFL getting sued and they cost them $1 billion or whatever. Aussie, that is. I think there are some of the codes here are currently either being sued or about to be sued. How important is it for a club? And we're just looking at sports people at the moment, but for a club to gather data on their players in terms of just defending, for example, what would be considered the duty of care. Is that a thing?
We think it is. And it comes down to identifying a cause and effect relationship, right? So there's enough emerging evidence now that head impacts cause, or too many head impacts, and I'll come back to too many, cause long-term neurodegenerative issues, right? So now if you reverse engineer that equation and you say, well, if you're trying to establish a cause and effect relationship, you have to measure the cause, right? You have to be able to quantify. It's like working in a factory. If the noise pollution is too much, you need to be able to.
If you can't measure it,
you can't manage it, right? Yep. This is the simple adage, or old adage, right? So for us, we say, well, there's a tool now that's been validated, extremely accurate, easy to use, that can help the clinician identify potential issues. So when you look at the data, you know, only 5 to 10% of concussions result in unconsciousness. So visibly, that's a really difficult injury to identify from the sideline, even the most experienced of doctors. So 90% of the time, these guys are running around who do have a concussion, undetected, undiagnosed, are continuing to run around and compound that injury. So this tool that we have and the technology that we have is effectively an intervention tool to be able to help the doctors identify this injury before it gets to the point where these guys are having to retire because they've had, you know, multiple or ongoing unmanaged and undiagnosed head injuries.
As in mini concussion, so to speak, at training,
correct,
or wherever.
Yeah, correct.
So because there are diagnostic tools that exist today, whether they're complete and accurate or objective enough is another issue. I mean, we have things like SCAT-6. We now got SCAT-6, not SCAT-5. We now got the VOMS. There are some other devices that are being developed by various organizations. You guys, I've noticed you guys have one on your website, outside of this mouthguard. Mm-hmm. But I think this is more. This is your mouth guard. We'll have a look at it in a second. But as I understand it, your mouth guard's more a predictive tool. In that, I guess you use AI, but your mouth guard for any one individual can say people who have experienced this impact measured by your mouth guard. That's in my mouth when I'm playing footy, whatever I'm doing. The level of that impact ordinarily would suggest that someone's had has received a concussion. Mm-hmm. Concussion is a weird word. It covers everything. Mm-hmm. You know, like it covers too many things. And it's not just about acute concussion. This is about lots of little concussions too. So instead of just saying you got an acute concussion, you got knocked out, you can't play for 11 days. Maybe you got 10 mini concussions over the last 5 training sessions. You can't play for 11 days. Mm. That's probably equally an important outcome for the player if the player's welfare is at the front of our screen.
That is true.
You know, and if we've got a duty of care, mm-hmm. as you said earlier, measurement, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So you can't just say, oh, I saw you might get knocked out. Because when you stood up, you fell over, or your legs went on you, or you're suffering from dizziness, or whatever the case may be, yep. or you're vomiting. Mm-hmm. Sure, that's a pretty obvious one. Mm-hmm. Come off 11 days. But your point, I think your point is if I suffer in that game 4 or 5 heavy impacts, and it might not even be to the head, mm-hmm. it could be to my body, mm-hmm. and I get whiplash. Mm-hmm. This is the idea. This thing he measures that. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Right. Yep. Yep. So I would ask you this. I'd imagine this is individualized because whilst, you know, like, I don't know, Gordon Tallis playing NRL might be able to take, or Jared Hargraves might be able to take much more impact than, say, Luke Keary. Mm-hmm. Or Sammy Walker playing for the East, because just by virtue of size, neck size, for example, mm-hmm. could play an important mm-hmm. part of these things. Mm-hmm. Skull size, thickness, body weight relative to the body weight, relative to the mass or force that's just hit you. Mm-hmm. You know, force is a big part of all this. And, sure. you know, we know force is the mass by speed. Mm-hmm. So this, I presume this is building data for each individual and then cross-referencing against the whole universe of data that you have. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been a big challenge in our journey is, you know, to get to the point that we're at to be able to do these wonderful things. We've had to collect a tremendous amount of data, right, and over a wide varieties of populations. So, yeah, there's a lot of different variables we have to control for, and all those ones that you mentioned are true, but you know, the brain tissue has, you know, everybody's brain tissue has very similar properties. And what we effectively measure is the biomechanics of the head, right? So we can measure the acceleration that is applied to the head. So
because these have accelerometers in them somewhere.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
In the mouth guard itself.
In the mouth guard itself.
Yeah. And maybe you could just explain what an accelerometer is.
Yeah. So it measures effectively the speed of movement in layman's terms. But we also measure the linear and the rotational acceleration. So there's two very different type of biomechanics that can be applied to the head. So the rotational acceleration is when you see guys get those sort of light clips to the jaw and you think, geez, that's an innocuous impact, but it's knocked them out, versus the linear impact, which is, you know, a traditional jab to the head in a boxing environment, for example. They both have very different outcomes. So, yeah, neck strength and all those different variables are important, but we measure this basically the biomechanics, the outcomes of the head, what happens to the head, whether it hits the ground, hits a shoulder, head-to-head impact, whatever might happen. We are measuring the biomechanics of that head and then using that data to infer basically the force that goes through the center of the brain.
And therefore
and we use algorithms and so forth to do
and
that.
And therefore predict something.
And that's where we do not currently predict, because we're not a medical device.
Okay, that's important. This is not a medical device.
It's not a medical device.
Right, so you didn't need to get TGA approval or anything like that?
Correct. So that's important to note.
But what is it then? What do you call it then if it's not?
It's just effectively a low-level measurement device.
Yeah, right.
So, but where we are at now with the volume of data that we have, we can start to apply these AI, ML methodologies to move into that arena. We've done a bunch of work internally with our R&D team where, we've got some promising sort of product roadmaps that will emerge. But the focus has been just on collecting the data.
Right. So did you guys, your team, develop this actual HIT IQ mouthguard?
We've developed it from scratch. Yeah.
And in terms of this particular mouthguard or your product, because as I understand, there's one or two others around I've heard of. Your one, prior to getting listed on the ASX, did you have to go out and get, or was it a mission critical to get patents, et cetera?
There's a tremendous amount of prior art in the literature. We do have a number of patents in application at the moment.
Yep. So patents pending.
Yep, patents pending. We've got two Australian innovation patents as well. So they cover design, utility, a variety of different areas of the IP. But it was a consideration, and we are obviously compliant as a business. But it's been sort of just build and iterate and work within the parameters that we have to work within.
So when you were listing, whoever was your sponsoring broker in terms of the listing process and the organisation that did the DD on you to talk to their clients, all that sort of stuff, they were happy with that. They didn't sort of say, look, patents are a big deal, because for the reason you just mentioned, they didn't sort of say, we must have patents in every country in the world.
No.
So what were the, before you went to market, what were the non-negotiables that the advisors that you guys had said, look, these are the things you have to get sorted in relation to, for example, to this particular device?
Yeah. So there was probably two things, and I think we had been in a really, prior to the listing, a really heavy R&D process.
Cost money.
Cost a lot of money. But one of the challenges that we've had is the sort of wheels of science move quite slow.
Mm.
So the actual publication and the evidence of utility and the actual tech working and the validation, all of that body of work that we had to do in the lead up to that process was one of the non-negotiables.
So okay, just stop there for a second, Mike. So that's an important one. So as I understand, these are the steps. You design it, you build it, your mouthguard that is, and then you've got to validate. It's got to be validated. So in other words, you've got to find guinea pigs to test it out on. You've got to find people to test it. You can't test it out on a mouse.
Mm.
It's not a mouse model. It's a human model.
Yeah.
So you've got to find people to validate it.
Yeah.
So what does that validation process look like? So I think what you just said, you had to do this pre-listing. So how did you go about validation? Who do you find?
Yeah, good question. So there's the word validation is a loaded term. There's many levels to what we've had to do. So the first one was purely, can you put electronics into a mouthguard without compromising A, the mouthguard, or B, the electronics?
And will the player wear it?
Yeah.
Well, comfortably. Is it comfortable?
Yeah. And from where we are, where we were to where we are now, from a size and comfort perspective, it's just out of this world how well we've been able to miniaturise the size of the device.
Electronics, yeah.
So, yeah, so can we, basic questions, can we even do that? And, we answered those pretty well. And then it was like, okay, well,
how'd you go about it? How'd you go about finding someone to validate it for you? Like, do you go on to a junior league or basketball?
So the first part was more of a manufacturing question. And that's where, my co-founder, Lucas Lang, he's a dental prosthetist and had the expertise in the prosthetics and manufacturing. So we went through that process and ticked that box. And then the next part was the data. Right. How do we actually extract data out of this thing, and how good is the data?
Because we're talking about sensor systems.
That's right.
And you therefore have to have software sitting on the other end, assuming the sensors work, which obviously they do, but a machine is receiving the data.
Mm-hmm.
I presume it's not going the other way. You're not sending anything in there, are you? You're not sending stuff back. So you're just receiving data. And then on the reception side, you've got software which banks the data.
Correct.
And then maybe interprets it, but at least banks the data. So you have to build software around that.
Mm-hmm.
So who did that? CTO staff?
Yeah, so we built all that on the back end. The primary concern through that validation process was actually validating the data.
Right.
And, you know, to give you some background, when we first started, the accuracy or the sensitivity of the device was at 40%.
Which means, 60% of the time it was wrong.
The data was just so, it was error prone.
And yeah. Well, either that or just unusable.
Yeah, and now we're at 97. So it's, you know, that's been a journey in terms of validating the actual data coming out of the guard. And we've had to do that in two ways. We've had to do it in lab. So test crash dummies and, you know,
not real people. Though.
Not real people. So yeah. we've built devices in our laboratory that is able to effectively, we can bash around and you know, we've instrumented those devices with really high-level sensory apparatus so that we effectively are comparing the ground truth, which is the sensors inside of the test dummy, versus the mouth guard, which is attached to the dummy. But when we started, there was nobody that could actually – that was fit out to basically complete that testing for us. So there's these cat crash test dummy facilities, but we were too small to engage with them. They didn't have the specific type of dummy that we needed. So we had to build it ourselves, which took longer than we had wanted and hoped. But we went through that process, and then the next part was the field validation. So yeah. Then we had to instrument actual athletes and record them.
How did you find them?
It wasn't that hard.
So
people were willing to participate.
But how? Like, I get
we had people out in the field sort of building relationships with groups that were willing to sort of help us out, really. So, but it was very structured, you know, in terms of what we needed and what we required from them. You know, we needed them to obviously onboard their athletes. They had to wear the technology. On the back end, we had to use video verification to, you know, capture all the impacts and then figure out the false positives and the false negatives, and then build algorithms to repair. And
did you do it with adults or teenagers or girls or boys?
It was done in amateur – studying the Essendon Footy League, actually,
right.
In Victoria. So it was just amateur male athletes to start with.
Yep.
And they were our sort of first testing protocol, and then we sort of evolved out and we started working with the AFL, the NRL some time ago. And the reason why we had to work with those guys is because of the quality of the vision that we required to be able to validate the field data.
So just so I understand that, the field data is coming off the mouth guard. So it's sending some data back to your system, which, you know, you're reading. But you need a video to say, yeah, well, actually he or she just got hit quite hard by someone's shoulder or arm or whatever the case may be, or the ball.
Yeah, well, that's right. So, you know, Mark's instrumented with our mouth guard. We've got the camera on Mark. The data file is synced up to the video file. And, oh, look, there's an impact, but he's just running around. There's no impact. Mm. So, he was yelling.
Yeah.
So the yelling creates an impact profile on the data.
Right.
So we've had to build, you know, over time, these algorithms that filter out all of the
false
noise.
Yeah, false positives.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and guys will put their mouth guard in their sock and go for a run, and the file will show that he's had 200 really high-level impacts, and we're like, well, he'd be dead. So that's not real data.
So the validation is really valuable.
It's really valuable. And it all goes down to trust and building a body of evidence around, hey, this actually works, and this is the work that we've done to prove it.
How long did the validation process take?
It took us over 5 years.
5 years, wow. Can I just open this up?
Yeah, absolutely.
My thumbs are no good, so maybe I'll get you to open up. Okay, just look. Right, so I can see you. So this is a sort of normal, traditional fitted mouth guard.
Correct.
And inside there we've got looks like some circuitry.
Yeah, so
and,
you've got a battery, you've got processors, you've got accelerometers, gyroscopes. There's an array of tech in there.
Yeah, so this charge is in there.
Correct.
Like a mobile phone sort of thing.
It's all wireless, yeah.
Yeah, this is now sending messages to somewhere else. Is it sending it to that and that sends it on, or where's the message?
No, because it's not in your mouth.
No, but how does it know it's in my mouth?
There's a sensor in there that can tell.
It's in my mouth. It's in my mouth.
In-mouth detection system. Yeah.
So that's important, because that way someone, as you say, put in their sock, it doesn't record anything.
Correct.
Yeah. So that once it's in my mouth, it detects it's in my mouth.
Yes.
It's obviously some some trick or secret that you guys own that says it detects, and then it starts sending messages. Is it constantly sending messages, or it only sends a message when there's an impact?
Yeah, so only when it surpasses a threshold.
Yep.
Do we record
right.
that data?
Right. Interesting.
So you know we can set that as low as we like. It's generally set around 5 Gs.
Yep.
So anything above 5 Gs.
Tell me what 5 Gs means. Like, I mean, I don't know what it is, but explain 5 Gs.
Well, 5 Gs, you know, you'll see.
What's it like?
So you'll see pilots do training at, let's say, 9G, and it looks quite intense. But that's 9G applied over time. So when you look at how long an impact exposure lasts for, it's only 5 milliseconds at times, sometimes 10 milliseconds. So it's a very short, sharp exposure to that force. So 5G is a really low-level impact. I mean, we've seen guys exposed to 120, 130G impacts, which are massive impacts. So we set that threshold relatively low and sort of disregard all the low-level, not important, you know, because even like changing direction, for example, or a jump and a land can elicit some level of a G-force. So we've set 5. I mean, the research is emerging on what the number needs to be, but we want to capture as much as we possibly can.
Right, okay. So you guys doing – how did you fund your process before you listed? So how is that all happening? Because, I mean, it sounds like 5 years. It's a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of design. I guess you've got mechanical engineers and – you know, electrical engineers building your, or you know, coders at least, or computer scientists building your software, etc. How is this all funded? What are we talking about, Branham, for example? Early days.
Yeah, early days. So, look at it. I mean, we've spent over sort of $25 million to date over the life of our journey.
Which is how long?
Well, we started seriously in sort of 2017.
Right.
2016 was a year of sort of experimenting and, you know, can we do this? But then 17 was when we first took external funding. And really, look, it's just been a high net worths that have helped us along. And
so how do you find a high net worth? I mean, everyone keeps saying like, you just go out there and scratch the surface and there's a high net worth sitting underneath the dirt. Like, where do you find high net worth from?
This is a good question. So, not coming from the corporate world, you know, that was obviously a big learning curve for myself as a co-founder and sort of the lead on the funding mechanism of our business. But it's door knocking.
Yeah, but how? And I mean, is there a high net worth list somewhere?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, you just meet people who then refer you to other people and say, hey, this guy might be interested, and then you just follow the breadcrumbs, so to speak, and you eventually meet enough people that, you know, you're able to, it's just like a sales funnel, right? Like you speak to 100 people and 3 will invest. So, you know, my black book is full of a lot of people who had who didn't believe in HitIQ and what we were trying to do. But that's effectively what it is. It's a sales funnel, and you're going out and you're trying to talk to as many people as you can. And, you know, you're telling the story and you're showing them a roadmap of what you think the next 12 to 18 months looks like. And most of the time you're wrong.
You're talking about VCs? Do you talk VCs?
We've not been on the VC radar.
Yeah.
We don't fit that model.
Right. What does that mean?
Well, hardware technology in Australia is a difficult proposition to fund. And, you know, we've sort of taken a path less traveled in the sense that, you know, this tech or IP is not born out of university land. So we funded it from day one, right, privately. So, you know, we just don't fit the VC model. Whether or not the addressable market is big enough for them, hardware tech is hard to fund, particularly in Australia, and the VC pool in Australia is obviously quite small as well. We did have a plan through 2019 that we developed that we're going to try and get some US funding, but then we got hit with the pandemic and that sort of threw things up in the air for a period of time, and then that event pretty much put us on
the ASX route.
Yeah, to a pathway to an IPO because we couldn't keep funding it as a private business. We needed the access to the capital and the public markets.
Right.
So Yeah, so that was pretty much the limitation that we had in the Australian market. The VC pool was really limited. We were generally attracted to, you know, high net worth, small family offices, you know, those types.
So you've now got high net wealth investing in it, helping you fund it along the way, but it's sort of pretty stressful, I guess, because you're always looking at your runway and you're probably thinking to yourself, my God, we won't last another 6 months. But yeah, get some more money. Perhaps go back and talk to these high net wealths that are already invested. Perhaps they might bring some more on. But at some stage around the COVID period, you decided to go on the ASX. When I look at your website, I notice you've got a lot of heavy hitters on your, looks like advisors or board members. You've got professors, etc. How important is it in terms of listing on the ASX, in other words, an IPO on the Australian Stock Exchange, how important is it for cred to have, you know, neuropsychs and neurologists, etc. on your, I can't remember if they're on the advisory board or on your board. Mm-hmm. How important is it to have those individuals there?
Super important. I mean, in all aspects of life, people look for social proof. You know, and having, you know, high level academics and researchers and practitioners who are supporting your journey and believe in your journey is a really good indicator, a good signal to, you know, the investment community.
How'd you get to them? I mean, I noticed that are they board members or advisory members?
No, they're on advisory boards.
Okay, because it's difficult to put them on the board because they have liabilities associated with being on the board.
Correct.
And you've got D&O insurance and everything, directors and officers insurance, which you've got to sort of sort out. So you put them on an advisory board, I get it, which you have to pay them something for. One of the neuropsychs you have on there is out of Newcastle University.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find these individuals? Do you get someone to put you in contact with them, or how do you select these particular individuals to be on your advisory board?
For a variety of reasons, and they all bring different skill sets to the table. But when, you know, I suppose when you maneuver through the journey and you start to get some momentum in the market and people are talking about you and you're trialing in the AFL, for example, or whatever it may be, you start to become a magnet for, you know, for people of this caliber. So the conversation becomes a lot easier. I mean, when we first started, it was a pipe dream, right? So you sort of have to tell the story and you got to onboard people and get them to believe, right? And that's not only the advisors and, you know, those type, but also your employees.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of the advisors, I mean, I think when you've got leading tech and you're actually solving a real problem,
which they're probably researching.
They're researching, and you're a real value add to them. They're a value add to you. So it's a really synergistic relationship. So,
what do you offer them though? Like, you have to. I know any detail, but do you have to offer them equity or cash?
Not equity. I mean, it's some of it's cash, a very nominal amount, really.
And why do they do it though?
Well, because they want to advance the space.
Yeah.
And they see us as being a primary source of doing that. So, you know, they want to be involved and they want to be part of the program. So that's, you know, there's a lot in it.
Do they want access to the data?
Yeah, there is some of that. We work in a confined space with data, right? Because of the sensitivity of not only the issue but also the data privacy laws and
I was going to say all the ethics associated with this stuff. Do you have to de-identify everybody?
Yeah, correct.
Everything's de-identified?
Everything's de-identified, but if the athlete wants to see the data, it's
okay.
It's okay.
If
they release the data, you know, that's also okay.
Are you sharing the data as it occurs with the athlete, with their healthcare provider at this stage?
This year we will be.
This year.
So historically we haven't.
Yeah.
And look, there's been in that journey in terms of educating the market, educating the medical people.
The clinicians leads, are really,
they're
it's a off. Big deal.
They're risk off, right? Yep. And you have to convince them and then you have to convince them again and then you've got to convince them again. So, you know, that process of educating the clinicians and the medical committees and saying, hey, this is what we're doing, this is the data, this is what it means. And it's just a process that you have to go through with them.
What platforms are you using, Mike? Like you're using, LinkedIn. I'm talking about, not publications, I'm not talking about medical publications, although I'm sure you guys are doing those things. But what platforms are you using to let's call it promote the idea, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera?
Yeah, so we've largely been a B2B play to date. So, you know, it's building direct relationships with people.
So the rehab people at the club, for example.
The medical directors and the club doctors. CMOs. Those types of characters, right? So building direct relationships with them, building trust, and just onboarding them on our journey and saying, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Right?
And just keep to continual updates. It's just relationship building, right?
But you've been doing it for 9 years. Yeah, it's a long road,
It's a long road, right?
So when did you list?
2021.
2021, middle of pandemic, which is pretty bit of a go.
Yeah. But the decision was pretty much made 12 months
prior.
So it takes that long to get go sorted. Through the process.
And how much did you raise?
We raised 10.
10 mil.
Yeah.
And it were all in, or did you take, or did someone take something? I mean, what's that process look like? So when you go to raise $10 million, obviously your sponsoring broker, if I'm assuming you have one, but your sponsoring broker says, do you want to take any on the table, or are you going to leave all the dough in there? A lot of times new shareholders insist that you leave everything in there because they don't want you to take anything off the table. So what was your process? How did you guys go about it?
Yeah, no, nobody took anything off the table. Yeah. For a variety of reasons. I mean, we're so small and there was so much yet to prove that it would have been a really bad signal if we did.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, and obviously the blue sky and the opportunity for, and where we were tracking and where we still are tracking obviously is, you know, could be a really significant business.
How do you establish a value? I mean, that's a pretty hard thing because, I mean, I don't know if you're probably not making revenue or much at that stage.
Yeah.
So it's not a revenue model valuation. So it may be in terms of total addressable market potential revenue, but like, how do you work out a value? Because you're giving away a percentage in return, $10 million.
Yeah.
I'm trying to work out, how do you work out what percentage you're prepared to give away?
Yeah.
Because then that's all subject to the value.
Yeah, yeah. And that, and that's the fight that you have with the brokers because they're.
But how do you work out a value? It's worth 100. Happy to give 10% away for 10. I mean, is that how it worked?
Yeah, I thought it was worth a billion. But it's a tough conversation because you look at what you spent and you're pretty much pre-revenue. I mean, we had a bit of revenue at the time.
Yeah.
But the revenue wheels hadn't started turning.
Yeah.
So you can't point to sort of multiples of revenue. So it's largely what's the dynamics of the market?
You don't have a user market either because you're not out there.
That's right. Yeah. So what do we think that – first thing is we need to get the 10 mil. So
10 is what you needed.
We need it,
to give you a runway. By the way, how many years is that?
2 years.
Two years. Runway.
Yeah. Right. So the first thing is you need the 10.
Yeah.
And then the next question is, well, what's the market going to accept as a valuation? What story can we sell, based on – and then the brokers obviously want it on the low end because they're selling it's easier for them and there's more upside. The founders and the shareholders, the existing shareholders want the higher number, there's a bit of push-pull negotiation.
It's an arm wrestle. There's no science. It's really an art.
It's an art, absolutely.
And you have to learn that art.
Yes.
I mean, I've been through the process a couple of times, but I just want to hear you say that because it is an art and there's no science. Because people look for science. They go, oh, my God, there must be some sort of magic formula, secret formula that everybody applies. Yeah. It's not scientific. Apply some science perhaps if you've got revenues or if you've got a million users or something, you maybe had to apply some sort of science that might be able to relate back to what someone else has done. Mm-hmm. But if there's none of those two, it's more art. In other words, you said we spend 25 mil. Maybe it's worth 25 mil because if someone else was to get to this point where we're at, it's going to cost 25 mil.
That's right.
So listed 2021. What did you think of the experience of the IPO?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? And how's it been so far? We're 2024 now. Wow.
Yeah. Look, there's just so many moving parts to listing a business. And when you're a small team like we were, you don't outsource too much of it. You do a lot of it yourself. Mm. So it's a big exercise. And then when you finally get to the listing day, it's a bit of a you take a deep breath and then you're back on the horse again because then you've got you run your business and deliver on, what you've told people you're going to deliver on. So, I wouldn't say it was a negative or positive. It was what it was. And, there was a small, there was a small hit on the share price on the day and then it sort of trailed off. And, we've had probably, if I was to sum it up in the last sort of 3 years or 2.5 years, it's been a challenging experience for a small cash-burning tech business in Australia, or globally really, hasn't been a friendly time for our type of businesses.
Well, tech businesses have copped a hard time.
Yeah, that's right. Tech businesses
generally.
Yeah, and you know, you're fighting for news flow and inherently the business that we're in is that to get a cornerstone customer, there's a long tail in that process. So you're not churning out really high volumes of news flow. So then that, you know, impacts the retail investor who doesn't have the patience to sit in.
Also, they get another offer coming up.
Correct.
And they just flip out and they, yeah. if there's,
and a, yeah, correct.
They go into the next deal.
Yeah, so you're fighting for liquidity in your stock and you're trying to get new people coming in and you're trying to grow your business. So it's been a real challenging time for us. But I think, we've really, kicked some significant goals over the last 2 years. We work with the Premier League, the AFL. There's a number of different organisations that are pretty developed in our pipeline that we're confident on landing. So we're, World Rugby have just mandated the technology. So we can see –
technology generally your stuff?
Sensor technology, yep. Mouthguard-based technology. So – and this was part of our vision when we started. We could see that there was a pathway to this happening and it's starting to unfold before our eyes. It's probably taken a bit longer than we thought.
It always does, but it is
trending. So we're pretty excited by what's coming.
Well, it's interesting, Mike, because right now this whole territory is trending around concussion and all the other things that are associated with concussion, and also measuring concussion and detecting concussion and rehabbing on concussion, etc. And I know your website's very cool. Like it's quite detailed and complete. I had a quick look through it this morning. It's pretty cool. And this stuff, sometimes you have to wait for people to catch up to their technology. I mean, like telephones, mobile phones. But you had to wait for people to catch up to their technology mm-hmm. sometimes. Yeah. Now the technology is trying to keep pace with the people, but consumers. But, it's a very interesting journey. And sometimes the main experience I say to people when you IPO is, how do you feel when you raise the dough? You're pretty happy. You're sort of relieved. The rest of it's management mm-hmm. after that, mm-hmm. And you can't control whether technology is not the darling anymore or becomes a darling or someone else lists and someone else becomes the darling. Mm. You can't control any of that.
That's right.
You, the CEO, you have to manage your way through it. But I'm glad you were able to raise the money. I'm glad you're able to do an IPO. And by the way, you're probably right. Trying to raise that sort of money at the time would have been very difficult with VCs, etc. Because Australian tech needs to be funded by Australians.
Correct.
And if ASX IPO is one way of doing it, then we should try it out and try and get it done and get it sorted so we can get science up to where it needs to be.
Yes.
So I'm going to follow HitIQ. As you probably know, I'm involved in the Sydney Roosters, and we are getting approached by lots of people in relation to the mouthguards at the moment. One of the things I will say to some of our players who should be wearing them during training don't like to wear them. Mm-hmm. In fact, they don't wear a mouthguard. I can't even believe it. Like, you're training without a mouthguard. Like, what's wrong with you? But it's more a habit. So you've got to change a lot of habits.
Yeah.
You've got to change a lot of behaviours.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
But over time, I think it'll become, especially as younger people come through, the new ranks, if they start off with this, it's just going to be, that's what we wear. And or if they're playing junior footy and they've already got one.
Yeah.
Like junior clubs, that's put right. them up. Correct. Are they expensive? Is price point an issue at the moment?
No, I mean we sell these things for $600-$700.
Right? The mouth guard,
yeah, the mouth guard,
the whole thing,
the hardware software package, yep. right? But what we sell is data.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
yeah.
That's our real
yep.
product.
Yeah,
we just use the mouth guard. That's the vessel.
Yeah,
but that price point will come down as we scale.
Yeah,
as we get economies of scale and we're able to fulfill larger order quantities and the price point will come down naturally. So like anything, right, when it first comes to market, it's more expensive yep. and the price point dwindles down.
Mobile phones.
Exactly right. So
I had one of the $4,000 ones back in 1985. So I know that.
Yeah.
And I was one of the guinea pigs early days. Well, Mike, look, a concussion is a big topic for me in my life. I love talking to people about this. HitIQ, I will be following. Thanks for sharing your experiences. More importantly, thanks for sharing your trials and tribulations, because it's not an easy thing to do. But the ASX helped you out. and it's been a good outcome. So Mike Vigor, co-founder and managing director of Hit IQ. Thanks very much, mate.
Appreciate it.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.